And by the way, that's a demand of the players' union, that there be an investigation into why he's been coddled for so many years. What he should do is turn the Los Angeles Clippers into a public utility for the city of Los Angeles, or into a fan-owned team like the Green Bay Packers, frankly, as a form of reparations for all the harm that Donald Sterling has done, not only to the fans of the Clippers team, but also to the literally thousands of people who've had to live in his housing projects in Los Angeles who've been harmed by his financial existence.
Dave, do you agree with the criticisms that the players should have done more? And what can they do if the NBA's response is insufficient?
Well, it's interesting. I actually, there have been so much talk on Twitter and on social media about, oh, the players should have done more. The players should have done something more drastic. They should have boycotted. What would John Carlos, the 1968 Olympian, what would he have done if he was in this situation? And all these people were saying this, so I figured, well, I'm going to pick up the phone and call John Carlos and find out. So I called Dr. Carlos, and first I asked him, has anyone in the big media called you to ask what you think? Because they're all referencing you. And he said, nope, I'm just sitting here. No one's asked. And I said, well, I'm going to ask you, Dr. Carlos, what do you think about what they did? And John Carlos, he thought that their symbolic statement of taking off their warm-ups, putting them at center court, was a powerful one because you had to get 12 people acting in collective fashion. And he said, look, you're going to have a lot of people of different political beliefs, ideas. Some may be more radical than others. If you can get all 12 to act in concert, then that's a good thing. He also said that the next step should be players walking into Donald Sterling's office and demanding to be traded at the end of the season. And he said fans should not show up to the game. And he said that Donald Sterling should have this team taken away from him.
And other teams, players and other teams like Miami Heat in solidarity.
Yeah, that was a powerful statement. They took off their uniforms as well, the warm-up jackets, and did their layups, not showing the NBA symbol, not showing the seal. And I think it's a powerful moment of solidarity because, look, I mean, we're living in a time where political statements by athletes on the court are pretty rare. I mean, the last time it happened in the NBA was when that same Miami Heat team posed with their hoods on when Trayvon Martin was killed and George Zimmerman was still not arrested. And so these kinds of statements are important because what they do is they push the discussion forward. And that's all you really have to ask of athletes. The only thing you don't want them to do when faced with something like this is to do nothing. And when you look at some of the amazing comments on social media by athletes like David West of the Pacers, who spoke about, you know, this shows that we don't live in any kind of post-racial America. I mean, that's an important discussion for us to have. And I think it shows the way that athletes can leverage their hyper-exalted brought to you by Nike platform to leverage it.
Earlier this month, switching gears slightly, critical flaws emerged in the handling of a rape case involving the star Florida State University football player, Jameis Winston. In December, the local prosecutor said he lacked evidence to charge Winston. About a week later, Winston won the Heisman Trophy. Now, the New York Times reports, quote, there was virtually no investigation at all, either by the police or the university. Police closed the case without interviewing Winston, obtaining his DNA, or following obvious leads to identify witnesses, including one who videotaped the alleged assault. The university also failed to take action, allowing Winston to keep playing football. The mishandling appears to extend to other cases at FSU, and the report comes as students across the country demand their schools take action to hold students who commit sexual assault accountable. Dave Zirin, talk about this case.
No, absolutely. I mean, first of all, as Jessica Luther has written, as we talk about this, we have to realize that rape on college campuses is not just a football problem, but it's something that affects an estimated 20% of college women. And so it's a broader problem in terms of how universities handle these kinds of cases. But in this particular case in Florida State, I mean, one of the things that it shows is that when you have a small college town like Tallahassee, you see the way the football program is an instrument not only of social cohesion, but also economic cohesion. Every Florida State game brings $1 million into the community. The police officer who is investigating this woman's claim that Jameis Winston sexually assaulted her, I mean, he's a member of the security team for the Florida State nonprofit Boosters Club, which donates literally hundreds of millions of dollars into the Florida State athletic department. So it's like one of those old company towns like in Matewan, except the industry isn't coal. The industry is football, and that means that people get protected. And what's so awful about it is that because college sports, particularly the revenue-producing sports, football and basketball, because they're so exploitative and because they're so dependent on African-American labor, one of the things that you see is these players are treated as both a combination of chattel and heroes, with women often used as a form of currency to lure players into different campuses with the promise that they will be able to live without sanction. So they're not paid an honest wage. They're not treated like actually grown people who are bringing money and funds into the university. I mean, they're treated in a way that I think you could only describe as abusive, which I think is the starting point for a lot of these sexual assault cases.
And Dave, very quickly, because we just have 30 seconds, but you were in Illinois last week covering this vote by Northwestern University football players on whether to form a union. Can you explain what happened in winning this right to vote and what happens next?
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to see results from this for months, but this is it directly connects to the discussion about Florida State, because this is about football players actually asserting their humanity and demanding to be treated like human beings, to have a seat at the table and to be able to say, we want a say in our health care. We want a say in our travel schedule. We want a say in what we bring to this campus, and not to be treated like, frankly, extensions of pieces of equipment.
Well, Dave Zirin, want to thank you for being with us, sports columnist for The Nation magazine, host of Edge of Sports Radio and Sirius XM. Zirin is the author of many books, including Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, with an essay in it on L.A. Clippers owner Donald Sterling. His forthcoming book about Brazil and the upcoming World Cup and 2016 Olympics is called Brazil's Dance with the Devil. This is Democracy. And when we come back, what happened in Vermont around GMOs? It's setting a precedent for the entire country. Stay with us.
It's all love. No dairy, no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school, my household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel, barbecue tofu, no fish though, no candy bars, no cigarettes, only ganja, fresh squeezed juice from oranges. Exercising daily to stay healthy, and I rarely drink water out the tap cause it's filthy.
Dead prezes, be healthy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Matte.
Well, we end today's show in Vermont, which is poised to become the first state to require the labeling of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. A pro-GMO labeling bill passed both chambers, is now on the way to the governor, Peter Shulman's desk, where he is expected to sign the bill as early as this week. The new law would take effect in July of 2016. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is among those who supports the effort to label GMO foods.
Of the matter is that labeling of GMOs is also not a radical concept. It exists throughout the European Union. In fact, it exists throughout dozens and dozens of countries throughout the world. So anyone who tells you that we can't do this, this is just too complicated, they're not telling you the truth.
29 other states have proposed bills requiring GMO labeling this year, and two have already passed bills requiring labeling, like Connecticut. But those measures only take effect when neighboring states also approve the requirements. For more, we go to Vermont via Democracy Now! Video stream to Vermont State Senator David Zuckerman of the Progressive Party. He's an organic farmer himself who introduced the GMO labeling bills more than a decade ago when he was in the Vermont House. He co-owns Full Moon Farm. David Zuckerman, welcome to Democracy Now, what happened? Explain what this bill actually means.
Well, what this bill means is in 2016, when the average customer goes into a store, they can look at a package, and on that package somewhere, there will be an indicator that the food was partially or completely made with genetic engineering.
And how did it happen? Talk about the origins of this legislation and why you think this is so important.
Well, really, in Vermont, we've been having discussions around genetic engineering in our food for well over a decade. And I've been in politics doing that as a spokesperson, really, for thousands of people across the state. And the momentum has just been building and building. We had a seed labeling and registration law that we passed about a decade ago. We had a bill that was going to require the manufacturers of these seeds to be responsible for them economically and environmentally. That passed but got vetoed by our governor about 6 years ago, a different governor, I should add. And then in the last couple of years, a real movement's been building for product labeling, as you know, both across the country and here in Vermont.
Now, when similar measures came up in Washington and California, we saw food companies and Monsanto spend tens of millions of dollars to defeat those bills. So what kind of opposition did you face here, and do you expect legal challenges after it's enacted into law?
Well, I think many people would be surprised that there was not the airwave bombardment like there was in California and Washington. And in part, I think that's because the average Vermonter was so much more aware that I think those companies felt it was an uphill battle here. They already had a population of people that were much more knowledgeable and wouldn't succumb to some of the propaganda that were in those kinds of ads, like your food's going to be 10% more, or this feeds the world, when really there's plenty of food in the world. It's other issues as to why people are hungry. On the other hand, I do think that it's likely that the Grocery Manufacturers Association or some organization that represents a lot of the food manufacturers will probably sue us. And a lot of our work here in Vermont was working to draft a bill that would withstand such a lawsuit.
I want to turn to Margaret Lagas, the executive director of United Dairy Farmers of Vermont, also a lobbyist for the trade group Biotechnology Industry Organization, whose members include seed manufacturer Monsanto. She told the Burlington Free Press that pro-labeling activists use scare tactics such as telling people they were being used as guinea pigs for GMO products. Lagas went on to tell the Burlington Free Press, quote, "Once you scare people about their food, it's such a personally intimidating thing for people. It's really unfortunate people have been scared when there's no sign to support it." This is Margaret Lagas speaking to the Council for Biotechnology Information in 2010.
Most people who are eating food today don't have any kind of a scientific background, and so they have no basis to understand what food biotechnology is. They don't understand the benefits to the environment, the benefits to the farmer. And so there's just a huge education problem. And really, if we're going to be super successful in the coming years to getting people to be very comfortable with this technology, we're going to have to do a lot more education and outreach.
So that is Margaret Lagas. State Senator David Zuckerman, respond. Why sure. You're so concerned about GMOs?
Well, for a long time, there actually weren't long-term epidemiological studies on the impacts for humans, and it only just started having reasonable studies because the seed companies controlled their seed and controlled their product for scientific research. Out of the European Union and some other areas, there are beginnings to signs of scientific questions around how it impacts our digestive system and potentially even crosses placental barriers into fetuses. So there's a lot of scientific questions. And so, yes, I do think as consumers we are guinea pigs because we really don't understand the ramifications of this. I would also add, as an organic farmer, one of the things that these seed companies have used in their product is a naturally occurring bacteria that they've taken the gene from to make those crops resistant to certain pests. Unfortunately, with overuse of those genetic technologies, some of those pests are actually starting to show resistance. There was recently an article in the Wall Street Journal around the corn borer. And over time, what that means is that those naturally occurring tools that folks like myself and other organic farmers use in a very judicious way, by overusing them in the biotech industry, they're going to make those tools obsolete, which means either more chemical use on conventional farms or certain products not even becoming available as organically produced, because eventually those pests would not be, we couldn't thwart those pests. So there's some real issues there. She also mentioned that environmentally this is a good tool. In Tennessee alone, it was reported in a national conventional agricultural magazine, they're going to have to spend $120 million more this year on added chemicals to their fields because glyphosate is no longer working like it once did. There are so many weeds that are resistant to it because of the overuse of Roundup Ready products that, in fact, now stronger and more volumes of chemicals are starting to be used. So those trends are really turning around on the biotech industry, and I don't think their information is accurate.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Vermont State Senator David Zuckerman of the Progressive Party, also an organic farmer. We will follow this legislation when Governor Peter Shumlin signs it, which he's expected to do very soon around the labeling of GMO products. That does it for our show tonight. Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez will be speaking at a screening of his film Harvest of Empire, History of Latinos in America. It's taking place in the Capitol at 5:30 in the Visitor's Center. Center. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for details. I'll also be speaking at Dartmouth College on Friday, May 2nd at 5 p.m. There's a change of time at Cook Auditorium, and you can check democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berker, Nick Feltzer, Amat Tenyamrin, Shakespeare Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mattei. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, well, thanks there, Amy. This is Finn. This is WUSB Stony Brook. It is 6 p.m. right here on WUSB, and that can only mean one thing. It's time for Off the Wall. Thank you.
Good evening, and welcome. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. And I still don't have health insurance. Yeah. But, you know, I'm being careful. I'm avoiding fights, and I'm avoiding intersections, and avoiding all kinds of different food and chemicals. And you should, too. It's the way to stay healthy, to stay out of the system. No, but seriously, The battle rages on as far as what happened to me. We talked about this last week. I don't want to really get into too much detail again this week. I got most of that off of my chest, which is also a healthy thing to do. So, you know, lowers your blood pressure, and that's always a good thing. But, you know, there has been some follow-up since then. Basically, the short story is these meatheads decided to drop my coverage and not bother telling me this until after the deadline had passed, making me ineligible to take one of the new Obamacare plans. Although, from what I've heard, those plans don't provide much in the way of coverage anywhere near where I happen to be, which isn't very convenient. The Kafka-esque conversation I had after the show last week, I received a call from my health insurance, my former health insurance company, wanting me to talk about reinstating my policy, which is great, you know? Wow, okay, talk about the power of the press, you know, getting the word out. Finally, I'm getting some results here. Turns out, what they wanted me to do was pay them for a month so that they could extend my policy until the beginning of March. Yeah. And I asked, well, what exactly do I get from that? That's March is over, you know, this is now April. What do I get from giving you more money for nothing? And I couldn't get past the answer of, it would extend your coverage until March. Yeah, you know what? Could extend my coverage until 1925, too. It doesn't make any sense. And I couldn't get past that. What I need is for them to extend my coverage until now. That way, I, for one thing, have coverage. And for the other thing, I can then go and get another plan. I'm not ineligible. Because I have it. It's a kind of bizarre system. And I can only imagine what other people are going through. And I don't blame the concept of national health care at all. But I do blame the implementation. I do blame the incredible power that these companies have to this day. What their excuse was, this is really incredible. They say that I was told, they sent out a letter in October saying that your coverage is good until the expiration date. And that was actually, and this is all something they claim, because I could not find any such letter. They say this is the second letter. The first letter said that that coverage would end as of January 31st. I'm sorry, December 31st. Then they sent out a second letter saying to ignore the first letter. And that second letter that said to ignore the first letter is the letter that I was supposed to have read, which said that my coverage was good until the expiration date. Which, even if I had received that letter, which I don't think I did, there's nothing in there saying, oh, by the way, your policy will be canceled as of that date. No, it was basically said in a rather pleasant way, according to them, that my coverage would be good until the renewal date. And renewal date implies that it's going to renew on that date. So there's not. I even asked them, there's nothing in there that said canceled, is there? And yet I was supposed to glean from this imaginary letter that I never got, I was supposed to interpret that and realize that that meant that I had to go and find a new plan by that particular date. So many assumptions. This is the same company, by the way. The way it worked before all hell broke loose, if you missed a payment, You cannot be canceled until a cancellation notice was sent. Fair enough, right? You don't pay them, then you get a letter in the mail saying, if you don't pay in the next 10 days, your insurance is going to be canceled. Well, what my insurance company did was print on the back of every bill, if you don't pay in the next 10 days, your insurance will be canceled. In other words, every bill was also a cancellation notice. So they never had to send the cancellation notice. Now, what this meant was, if you somehow, for whatever reason, missed a payment, then you were canceled without any further notice. So it could have gotten lost in the mail, you could have just plumb forgotten, all sorts of things might have happened. But you wouldn't get any notice saying that there was a problem. This enabled them to get out of lots of insurance policies and enabled them to double or triple the cost when the desperate person tried to reinstate the coverage. And it just shows you the kinds of people we're dealing with. The trickery, the outright lies. And these are the people deciding on our health care. It's disgusting. So clearly, Obamacare does not go nearly far enough, because if it did, these people wouldn't have the kind of control that they do. These kinds of games wouldn't be possible. But they are. And I continue to float along on absolutely no insurance right now because of national health care. It's really bizarre and strange. And hopefully this fight will be over in the next couple of weeks. We'll see. But that's one thing, just one thing in all that's going on. And I'd like to hear from our listeners. We're not begging for money this week. No, it's over. But I'd like to hear from our listeners maybe later on in the program, you know, call in show and all that. I won't be here in 2 weeks. 2 weeks, in fact, heading overseas. And it's kind of interesting. I don't know if anybody watched the game today. Yeah, you see, I can say that, and nobody knows what I'm talking about. That tells me I'm watching the right game, because it's not something that is being followed by all the people here or any of the people here. I'm talking about the second leg of the semifinal of the Champions League. Yeah, probably a lot of those words don't make sense to many people here. But it's interesting, fascinating, and kind of coincidental, because it all sort of focuses on where I'm going to be at the exact time that all this is decided. And it wasn't planned that way. Today was the second part of... Yeah, they play games in two parts in certain tournaments. How that works is you play on the home side of one team, and then you play the second game on the home side of the other team. And what you do is you add up the scores. It's called aggregate. And whoever has the highest score, it's like a double game. So you could actually lose the second game but win the competition, because your score from the first game beat the score from the second game. Now, many times it's tied and they have to decide based on away goals and all sorts of other criteria, but that's how they do this particular round of this particular game, this particular championship called the Champions League. Now, the Champions League is comprised of various champions from different countries. So if you win your league in, say, England, then you go to the Champions League and you compete in that league as well. All at the same time that you're competing at home in your regular league. It gets very complicated and complex. And it's not the only thing going on either. You know, every country has their division title, league title, where basically the team that has the most points at the end of the season is the champion. That's it. But then you have a cup, where all kinds of teams start off, and it basically is an elimination tournament. And that culminates around this time of year as well. In England, it's called the FA Cup. And so you have a champion of the league, and then you have a cup champion, sometimes of the same team. But both of those teams, and if it's the same team, then a different team that placed second in one of those tournaments also qualify for the entire European Champions League, in which they compete against other teams from other countries that did the same thing. And if that's not enough for you, there's another championship called the Europa League, which is comprised of teams that didn't make it to the Champions League, but are still pretty good. And gets even better. teams that get eliminated in the Champions League up to a certain point can then join the Europa League in progress. Yeah. I don't know how anybody can figure out where they're supposed to show up to play a game. I really don't know that. This doesn't even take into account friendlies, which are exhibition games. Doesn't take into account national games, which is your country playing against another country, i.e. World Cup qualifying. But there's an awful lot of football being played out there. Football being what the rest of the world calls it. Of course, we call it soccer. And today was the second half of the game between Bayern Munich, who are the champions. By the way, they're the champions of the Champions League. They're the champions of the Bundesliga, which is the German league, and the German Cup as well. It's called a treble when that happens. But they weren't so much the champions today because they were facing Real Madrid, who are a very good team from Madrid, Spain. And they played the first game a week ago Wednesday in Madrid. And they won 1-0, 1-0. So it was expected that when they went to Germany today and faced the champions, that Munich would at least be ahead 1-0. Maybe more. That's not how it turned out. Turned out Real Madrid won 4-0 in Germany. So they were kind of shellacked over there. So what this means Real Madrid has moved on to the final, which is taking place in Lisbon, Portugal, I believe on May the 24th. Which happens to be the day that I was planning on being in Madrid before going on to Lisbon. Isn't that kind of weird? So no matter what, there's going to be excitement and craziness in the streets. And it not even finished yet, because there's a second semifinal. There have to be two, obviously, for there to be a final. That's being played tomorrow, the second half of that competition between Chelsea from England and, guess what, Atletico Madrid, another Madrid team. So the possibility exists. The first game was 0-0, no scorer. If, for whatever reason, and I think they have the disadvantage, but if Atletico Madrid were to win against Chelsea tomorrow, for the first time in the history of mankind, a Champions League final will involve two teams from the same city. Last year, it was two teams from the same country. It was an all-German final. This year, it could be an all-Madrid final, and I will be in Madrid when that happens. Sometimes you get the sense that there's predestiny out there, that you're just a pawn in some bigger game. And I don't mean this game. I mean a bigger game, a game where you just happen to be steered in a particular direction. Because why else would I wind up in Madrid on such a day and then move on to Lisbon after that, which is where the game is taking place? Isn't that so much more interesting than watching the Mets? Well, no, you never know what's going to happen with them. But it's just so intriguing and complex. I find myself spending more time figuring it all out than actually watching any game, because I find the system to be really, really interesting. And so international as well, because every country pretty much does the same thing. Now, we do things differently here, of course, because, well, we just like to be different. But in most countries, the system I describe with the cups and the leagues, that's how they do it. And at the end of every season, you have something called relegation, where the last three teams, or different numbers depending on countries and number of teams, but the last three teams get bumped down a division to a lower division. And the top three teams in that lower division get moved up to the upper division. And they have many, many divisions. So it's possible. It's possible for teams to plummet. So if, say, Manchester United continues playing badly, they could wind up in the second division in a few years. Or maybe even next year if they do terribly. And then they're playing lesser teams, so obviously they have a better chance of moving back out of there, but they could continue to plummet and go down into the third division, etc., etc. And on the other hand, a lowly team could really make a go at it and wind up playing against champions. It's It's something that doesn't happen in this country. You just have basically the same thing year after year here. But imagine if the last place team in whatever sport you follow just wasn't around the year afterwards. They're in a different league playing different teams. It's a totally different way of thinking of it. So I think that's what draws me to it. It's just the differences, the complexity, the possibilities. And yeah, the game's kind of interesting too, sometimes. So that's what I was looking at before I came over here. And looked at various bits of news that are going on in the world. Where shall we start? Well, okay, you know, we've... I guess Georgia and Ukraine will be the topics. Okay, how's that? Georgia and Ukraine, two trouble spots? Yeah, I don't mean their Georgia. No, I mean our Georgia, the one here. Yeah, their Georgia had a war with Russia a couple of years ago. That didn't go so well for them. And people are seeing parallels in Ukraine. A little different, but similarities. But our Georgia is having some real issues as well. Last week, this was after the show, I certainly would have mentioned something about this. But last week, Georgia decided, or the governor of Georgia decided that it was time to sign a gun law. Well, actually, it's not a gun law, is it? It's pretty much a gun free for all. Yeah, well, you know, after all these mass shootings, some states took action and did something to make it a little bit more difficult. Not nearly difficult enough, but a little more difficult to get your hands on deadly weapons. Now, a lot of people say, yeah, you know, what difference does that make? Evil people are still going to get their hands. You know what? Evil people are always going to be able to do something evil. But most of the people that do bad things because they snap, because it's a split-second decision. And if you make something easy, really, really easy for them to get a hold of, that's going to be within arm's reach, guaranteed. You make things a little bit more difficult, even a little more difficult, and that changes. And I think the evidence is out there. If you look at where all this bad stuff happens, it tends to be in places where guns are pretty easy to get a hold of. And yeah, the armed gangs of people that are constantly breaking into homes that we hear about in all these stories from the pro-gun people, yeah, they're still going to have their guns. Yeah, you're not going to stop that. And your guns aren't going to stop that. The only thing that's going to stop that is if we figure out how to make guns not work, or if we spread a whole lot of peace, love, and understanding to the whole world forcefully and change a lot of attitudes out there. I don't see that happening either. But anyway, what happened in Georgia? Georgia Governor Nathan Deal. Remember that name. Probably going to be a president someday. Weird name, President Deal. Nah, I don't know about that. He basically gave the National Rifle Association a big present. Well, they were having a conference over in Indianapolis, and this was done right before the conference. So last Wednesday, Deal, who is a... What? You want to guess? No, he's not a Democrat. He's a Republican. Is that a surprise? No, I don't think anybody's surprised by that. Deal signed into law what critics dubbed the Guns Everywhere Bill. Oh, yes. And the NRA was happy to say it's the most comprehensive pro-gun legislation in state history. Which is pretty much the same thing. Under this law, holders of concealed carry permits can now bring their firearms into all kinds of public places, including bars, churches, and government buildings. And this law, which, by the way, takes effect on July 1st, so it's technically not in effect now. It also allows hunters to use silencers. I can't figure that one out. Why do hunters need to use silencers? It's not enough that you're sneaking up on some poor animal with a gun. But now, what, you don't want the other animals to hear what's going on? What's happening here? Mobsters use silencers. Hunters, I always thought, were kind of happy to broadcast to the world, hey, I just killed me something. You know, it's... Well, bows and arrows, I suppose, don't do that. But still, this is a kind of a weird thing. And also, this law allows schools to permit staff to carry guns onto campus. And, you know, it was even bigger than this. It got whittled down just a little bit. Originally, it also included a controversial campus carry provision that would have legalized carrying guns on campuses, period. Not just with the permission of the university. Another provision would have permitted guns in places of worship, unless religious leaders specifically banned them. But the new law basically says religious leaders have to opt into this program. So it's not that much of a difference. They just have to kind of say, yeah, all right, we give in. You can carry a damn gun into our service. You know, you have to just ask yourself, what is going on here? Why do people feel the need to carry their guns everywhere? And invariably, the answer you get is to protect themselves against all the crazy people carrying guns everywhere. Now, think about this. We're making legislation to protect ourselves against the people who that legislation helps. And that's really the main reason for it. You know, if people weren't carrying guns everywhere, you wouldn't need to feel like you had to carry your gun to protect yourself. And it's that logic that I can never seem to convey properly. And I don't think anyone else has had much luck with it either. If you convince yourself that you're constantly at danger, then you're going to want to protect yourself. That makes sense. You can never convince somebody they're not at danger if they truly believe they are. And so you get laws like this. And look at this. Almost on cue, today there was a mass shooting in Georgia. A FedEx Corporation package handler, armed with a shotgun, opened fire at a shipping facility in suburban Atlanta, injuring 6 people before killing himself. Fortunately, didn't kill anyone else, at least not yet. Say the 19-year-old walked in looking like Rambo, with all kinds of bullets strapped to him, and was he in camouflage? You know, who knows? But this points to other issues, too. Where people see all kinds of violence and it's pounded into their heads in one form or another. And it's seen as cool. It's seen as okay. Now, you know, it's very different from saying the media should not be allowed to broadcast things like this. Movies should not be made like this. Because you can't do that. You can't limit freedom of expression that way. But you can change attitudes. You know, it's legal to be a racist in this country. But you can make it awfully uncomfortable to be a racist in this country by changing the attitudes. And we've seen that over the years. We've seen the reaction to that idiot who owns the LA Clippers making his comments. And even though they were comments that he thought were private, they went out to the public. And there's been a big reaction. I mean, I can't say I'm exactly surprised that this rich old guy who has a history of racism is a racist. Yeah, you know, not exactly a newsflash, but it's the new Flight 370 for the news channels. But that kind of reaction against what he said could not have happened a couple of decades ago, because our attitudes were different. And so in the same way, when you're dealing with violence, instead of embracing violence, we can reject violence, push it away, say, that's disgusting, that's not what I'm into. It's not cool. And then you don't have people walking into their places of work with Rambo gear on, thinking that they're going to emulate their hero. And maybe you have less people walking around with guns thinking that they can protect themselves that way. And then you have less people who fly off the handle during an argument and wind up doing things that destroy lives in a split second. Now, we've seen other instances over the last couple of weeks involving knives. couple in Canada. There was one somewhere in the States. There's always something going on in China. And China, they actually kill a lot of people with knives. It's really very disturbing. But at least the instances that we've heard about here, it's mostly injuries, mostly horrible injuries. And the reason for that is obvious. With a gun, you can kill people a lot quicker, a lot more effectively than with a knife. You have to get up close. It gets bloody and messy. And it's, you know, harder to kill yourself with a knife than it is with a gun. It's a commitment. It's painful. It's messy. Which is why a lot of people don't do it that way. But as we see with these instances, the violence is still there. You take away people's guns, they're going to strike out with something else. But it won't be as fatal, because it won't be as effective. One part of the problem might be dealt with. The other part of the problem is still there. And that's the violent tendencies. We live in a very violent society. This has been proven over and over again. You can have other countries with the same amount of weapons, yet they have less violence. And hence less, an overall percentage of violence by guns, even though they have the same amount, percentage-wise. So you don't solve the whole problem by just dealing with one of the issues. The prevalence of guns is a major issue. The prevalence of violence is another major issue. They both have to be dealt with for the problem to go away. And we all seem to be missing that. We might get one of the aspects of it right, but we totally ignore the other aspect of it. Anyway, that's a story in progress. And other states are doing similar things to what Georgia did. Arizona, for instance, the conservative governor, Jan Brewer, has again revealed a moderate streak. She vetoed NRA-backed legislation that would have allowed gun owners to carry firearms into some public buildings. She said, "I'm a strong proponent of the Second Amendment, and I have signed into law numerous pieces of legislation to advance and protect gun rights. However, I cannot support the measure in its proposed form." Everybody has a line. Look at that. And it pretty much goes to show that if you give someone an inch, they'll take a mile. They won't stop. She's given an awful lot to the NRA, but they keep coming back for more. So, for all that's happened in Arizona, that's one good thing that's happened. Kansas passed a law on Wednesday stripping local governments of their ability to restrict the state's open carry law. So, you can't override it locally anymore. Kansas's governor, Sam Brownback, said Kansans have long believed the right to bear arms is a constitutional right. And Colorado, let's see, Colorado found itself in the crosshairs of gun rights groups last year when the Democratic governor, John Hickenlooper, signed into law sweeping new gun restrictions. And that put into place tough new restrictions that expanded background checks on private sales, limits on ammunition magazines, among other provisions. Nothing that actually took guns away from people, though. But that was enough. Through all the fallout, two Democratic lawmakers were ousted in a recall election, and another was forced to resign to avoid the possibility of a similar fate. This year, Republican state lawmakers introduced a slew of bills aimed at rolling back or repealing last year's law, but it was to no avail. Their efforts were blocked repeatedly by Democrats who still control the legislature. So, not all bad there either. And finally, South Dakota. Republican-controlled legislature passed a rare gun-related bill that found support among groups typically in fierce opposition. Yeah, in March, South Dakota's governor, Dennis Daggard, signed into law a bill that will add the names of certain people who are mentally ill to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System in an effort to keep them from buying guns. So that's one step, I suppose. Not nearly enough, but something. And, you know, it's also hard to categorize people as mentally ill. Unless they've been committed or have done something particularly horrible. The battle rages on. That's what's going on in our country. Okay, let's go to another country. Let's go over to, what country is it this week? It's still Ukraine or is it Russia? Who knows? It seems to be open to contention at this point. One thing that is true, though, is that the mayor of a Ukrainian city was shot the other day. And what I found interesting about this was that in the media coverage, invariably you see headlines such as Ukrainian mayor shot in the back. Now, what's your reaction to that when you see a headline like that? Ukrainian mayor shot in the back. What kind of coward shoots somebody in the back? Ukrainian mayor? What? Those damn Russians. Will they stop at nothing? Look at how they're behaving. With all kinds of violence and cowardice. Dirty tricks. Shooting a mayor in the back. Well, here's the thing. The thing they didn't mention in these media reports. This Ukrainian mayor was pro-Russian. Yeah, because, you know, they are still in the Ukraine. The eastern part of Ukraine is strongly pro-Russian in many areas. Not all areas. But he was one. Now, it's said that he has softened his stance a bit. I don't know how true that is. I haven't been able to find any quotes from him as to what exactly he's been saying lately. But I think that might also be a bit of disinformation to maybe shift our suspicions again to the Russians to say, yeah, okay, he was softening his stance, so they sent a warning to him not to do that, or to anybody else not to do that. What's not being said anywhere, in our media at least, is that could these have been Ukrainian ultranationalists? Because, you know what, they can get violent too. I see the violence that the Russians, the pro-Russian, they are Ukrainian citizens after all, the pro-Russian group of people, I see the violence they're responsible for. And it doesn't make them look very good at all. That's part of that whole rejecting violence thing going on. It makes them look like evil thugs. And no doubt there are a bunch of evil thugs in the middle of all this. Doesn't make you look good when you abduct people either. Whoever these people are who took members of a monitoring force hostage and forced them to say that, oh, we're the guests of these people. they do this every single time there was a conflict. Remember, Saddam Hussein did that. It's been done in Syria. It's been done in all kinds of places. And I try to understand the mindset of the people behind that. Do they really think that, yeah, this will convince the world that we're right because we're going to take a bunch of people and hold them against their will and get them to say things that agree with us, and then the world will see that we're right? It never seems to cross their minds that the very act of taking people hostage is what's going to turn people against you. So clearly, those people who did that aren't doing their cause any favors whatsoever. And as to the legitimacy of that cause, you know, I think that's something that's really open to debate and should be discussed. Now, clearly in the case of Crimea, the vast majority of people there wanted to join Russia. I saw no problem with that. What's the point of holding on to a province that fiercely does not want to be part of your country when there's a country right next door that they do want to be part of? Seems like a no-brainer to me. It gets more complex, though, as you move into other areas of eastern Ukraine. And in some of these places, if you were to take a vote, the pro-Ukrainian side would probably win. Because they have something like a 50-40 majority. So if everybody voted along their particular language or country of origin lines, then the pro-Russian factions would not win. And they're the ones calling for a referendum. So, what would be harmed by having the referendum to see how people feel? I guess precedent, you don't want to give people that kind of power, but in the end, that really is what it's about. That's what it's always been about in that particular region. So many regions in that particular part of the world, open to contention, basically being handed off from one country to another. I was reading this whole back and forth about the city, I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong, even though I've been in the country, the city of Wrocław in Poland, it's spelled W-R-O-C-L-A-W. Yeah, I have no idea how to pronounce it. I'm sure it's not that. It's in Poland, and there's contention that that was taken from Germany, and people have spellings of the city to prove that it's a German place. And then before it was German, it was Czech. And basically, all these regions, all these areas, all these nationalities claiming things, having these long, bitter feuds that last for centuries. Hungary, Romania, Serbia, you name it. It just goes on forever, and people are so serious about all of this. We can look at this, and this is one of the advantages of being in this particular country. We can look at this and say, what is the big deal? Who cares? You know what? So you're part of Russia now. You're part of Ukraine now. Does it really matter that much? Well, yeah, it probably does matter because one is in the east, one is in the west. But is it really worth escalating and building things up to the degree where it's getting kind of scary? You know, you have these Russian troops massing on the border of Ukraine, and now you have Americans getting involved, sending troops to Poland. None of this is a coincidence. These are all messages being sent. And it doesn't take much. It doesn't take much to go down a very dark road and make this about a whole lot more than a contested region. It's not like this is new territory. It's not like Russia invading Spain. These are places that many different groups of people have claimed to, and that have been the sites of conflicts for hundreds and hundreds of years. But one thing that was not there hundreds of years ago were Americans. We don't need to be involved in this. We need to make sure people aren't being slaughtered or ethnically cleansed or things like that. But as far as borders go, sort that out. This guy that's running Ukraine right now, his name is, I'm sure I'll pronounce this wrong too, Arseniy Yatsenyuk. And if you watch him on television, he looks like a deer in headlights. He really does. He looks completely out of his element. He's a young guy. He's only 39, thrust into this position, clearly in over his head. And whenever he says something, it's always tinged with drama and exaggeration. What I see is exaggeration. It's almost funny to basically hear what he predicts the Russians will do next. And if you look at the party that he is a part of, that the leadership of Ukraine is now mostly a part of, it's called the That's the other thing. We're just sort of repelled from stories like this because we can't pronounce the words. How do you pronounce S-H-C-H? How in God's name are you supposed to pronounce that? You know what? I'm going to split it in two. I'll go Badkivshchina. Is the name of their party. Yeah, if you want to join their party, good luck. And they have certain stances on various things. It's all over the place, actually. They want to simplify procedures for opening and closing of businesses. Okay, that sounds good. They also want to establish a new minimum wage, and they want to raise wages and pensions and lower taxes. They want to limit the kind of taxes to 7. Oh, that's a good number. Simplify the methods of payment, minimize the possibility of tax evasion through offshore companies. They also want to create a public nonprofit construction company that will build affordable housing. Sounds really good. They want to campaign against corruption. They advocate an anti-corruption lustration, is that a word? Whereby state officials' expenses and property values are compared with their tax declarations. And if there's a discrepancy, the officials will be criminally charged and banned from public office. All sounds really good. Only citizens of Ukraine will have the right to private ownership of land, but high concentration of land in one hand will not be allowed. They see Ukrainian membership in the European Union as a strategic goal. The party wants to prosecute law enforcement involved in political repression. And let's see, what else here? They want to introduce jury trials into the Ukrainian law system. They want to depoliticize the process of appointment of judges. They want to improve human rights in Ukraine. They believe this thing way back in the past, in the Soviet Union days, the Holodomor, was the genocide of the Ukrainian nation. That was a really kind of bizarre story of starvation that took place. Man-made starvation. And they believe that was the equivalent of a Holocaust there, which it's an interesting party to look at. But here's the other thing that's in there. If you dig, you'll see that they're fiercely opposed to raising the status of the Russian language. Meaning that Russian is not to be a second language, not a first language, a second language. Even though it's spoken by up to half the population in the East, by over 90% in the Crimea, these guys wanted to keep it from being spoken officially. Now think about the effect that has on people who live in that country and are of that particular ethnicity. They might feel that they're under occupation, that they're being discriminated against, because they are. So can you be surprised when they try to break away, when they embrace other nations? So there's a lot of wrong to go around, and there's a lot of stupidity and obstinance that we're seeing plenty of. And while here in this country, we don't really fixate on things like that for centuries, because we haven't been around that long, that might be our biggest advantage. In other countries, we see ethnic hatred that dates back so long, we can't even conceive of it. And feuds based on actions of people that have completely disintegrated in the ground by now. All right, I've yammered on for long enough. If anybody is out there still, ring the phone, 631-632-6901. If I see the phone ringing, I will shoot into delay, and we'll try and take some phone calls. But if I don't see phones ringing, I'll assume that, once again, the audience is asleep, and we'll do something else instead for the remaining couple of minutes that we have. Speaking of other countries, 683 Islamist supporters sentenced to death in Egypt. You know, and you have to wonder, why do they feel like maybe they need to step it up a bit with that kind of crazy reaction, just for being members of a particular outlawed party that was actually in control a year or so ago? All right. Hey, you know what? We're getting phone calls, so I'm going to quickly move into delay. Let's try and do this as quickly as possible.
Hi, this is Jeff from Wilco, and you're listening to WUSB Radio Free Long Island.
And here I am in delay. Wow. Okay, that was pretty quick. 631-632-6901 is our telephone number. Let me just adjust these levels and see who's out there. Good evening. You're on Off the Wall.
Hey, what's going on?
Not much. Seems like you're not coming through the board, though. Keep talking.
Oh, okay. Real quick, probably doesn't have anything to do with anything that you spoke about today, but I just have to remember the past couple of weeks, been a load of lawsuits that New York City is paying out money for whatever reason. And I know this is kind of a dumb question, but my question to you, do you have any idea if you live out in Suffolk County or in Nassau County, do any of your taxes go into New York City for those stupid lawsuits?
Any of the taxes, which lawsuits are we talking about?
Any of them, you know, that stupid thing with the fire department not hiring enough minorities, or the cops beating somebody up, or, you know, any lawsuit that I see in New York City, you know, wrongful injury, any of that kind of nonsense. Any of that come out of, like, taxes for people who don't live in the city?
Oh, I would imagine probably not, but I'm more concerned why you think that's nonsense.
It's real simple, because if I live out in Suffolk County, I don't really care if...
No, that part I see. Yeah, that is nonsense, but the lawsuits themselves aren't nonsense, are they?
Oh, no, not that. No, okay. The lawsuits, I guess, you know, everybody wants their fair share, I guess.
Well, justice is more like it, you know? I mean, I just got off a lawsuit from the city for being arrested in 2004 for standing on a street, and let me tell you, it's... getting that kind of closure, it's not about the money. It's about just realizing that you were listened to, you know, and somebody did something about it.
That's true. Actually, I didn't think about that. I forgot about that. But yeah, what I was getting at is I was wondering if any of, like, my tax dollars went to any of those.
Well, I mean, they shouldn't, but by the same token, the people in New York City, they didn't do this either. I think the money should come out of the people that are guilty, but we never seem to see that. You know, whenever there's a fine of some sort, it's not the person that was wrong that gets the fine, it's the government that gets the fine. So a lot has to be changed for this to be a bit more fair.
I guess you're probably right about that. I guess that does make sense, though.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that. But
well, you've helped me diagnose a problem here that we've been having here at the radio station. Apparently, if anybody's listening who also does a call-in show here, if you grasp the wire on the left-hand side of the phone in the back and push it in as hard as you can, like I'm doing right now, then the audio will come through the board. Otherwise, it won't.
Hey, let me ask you a question. Are you guys still using, I know it's a dumb question, but I'm full of those today. Are you guys still using that same board that's gray with those hand-sized knobs?
No need to describe it. We have only used one board at this radio station. So, yes, it would be the same board.
Really? I was visiting a friend of mine who was doing a show there years ago.
Uh-huh.
A visitor, and I saw the board. That's pretty impressive. I'd never seen one before. It was 150 years ago. I'm just wondering if you guys are still using the same board.
It's pretty much 150 years old. And all kinds of things. The problem I'm having right now with the wire, that's a wire. We can fix a wire. But, for instance, your volume here is on this channel, and when I adjust your volume, you get... you're not getting it now. How about that?
actually sounds different there, to me, but that's probably on my end.
You hear that staticky noise. That's coming from inside the board. And you know what's not happening now? Okay, so this board is intelligent and it knows what it's doing. But usually when I turn this knob, I hear static, and now I'm not hearing it. So if I talk about it, it won't happen.
You know what?
Oh, there it is. As soon as I stop, it came back.
Oh.
Go ahead.
What model that board is? Because I like to Google it just for the heck of it to see what, you know, what it went for in its day and, you know, the things that it can do.
What is the model of this board? Does it say it on it anywhere? I feel like an idiot because I should know this. It's a Harris. I do know that much. It's a Harris board, but I don't know anything more than that. You know what? I'll try to find out, and I can talk about
that. Start and look down. I'm just curious, like I said.
Yeah, I'll try to find out and mention it next week. How's that?
All right, good enough. I appreciate it.
It's a good question. All right, thanks so much for your call.
Not a problem. Thanks for taking mine.
Take care. And unfortunately, that's all the calls that we can take tonight because we've run out of time. And I've also run out of CD players. Hang on, I got to put the outro over there because this one's not working apparently. Our email address is otw@2600.com. As always, please write to us. We'd like to hear your thoughts and opinions, contradictions, what have you, whatever it is on your mind. That's what we're all about here. So Finn's coming up next with Finn's Revolution. We'll be back again next week with all kinds of fun things. Emmanuel for Off the Wall. Have a good night.
Spinning it the right way. Just what you do now with the kind of thing. But then you get up, but then you're working hours, saving up the door. Little words based on lies, lies. Oh, it's such a pleasure, never ever get it right. Healthy body, sick mind. Working overdrive, healthy body, sick mind. Too hectic, too hectic, healthy body, sick mind. When you're just a boy, it's just a man on top. Sick body, sick mind. Cause your life is under martial law. You got everything to lose. Your parents are so paid off. Run, but it can't like run. Then you're working hours, sleeping underneath the drug. Better work, it's a la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Always watching for you, never ever satisfied. Healthy body, sane mind. Working overtime. Healthy body, sane mind. Too hectic, too hectic. Healthy body, sane mind. When you're just a one, it's just a matter of time. Sick body, sick mind.